This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Seems everyone's talking about President Trump's power to pick Supreme Court nominees. And understandably so. The conversation kicked up after Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement, which is coming at the end of this month. Now, presidents get to choose other judges, too, judges that hear a lot more cases than the Supreme Court does. President Trump is leaving his mark on those lower courts, especially appeals courts, at what some are calling a historic rate. So far, he has appointed 44 judges, 88 more nominations are pending, including 23 at the appeals level. That's more than any administration has ever advanced in this amount of time. Now, one of the reasons the president's nominations have been so successful is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here is part of what Mr. McConnell said to conservative radio talk show host Hugh Hewitt back in May.
It's a top priority for me. I don't think there's anything we can do in the United States Senate that's more important for America than confirming judges as rapidly as we get them.
Why have there been so many vacancies to fill? And what do lower court judges do anyway? Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. These days, keeping up with everything in the news is hard, whether it's politics or pop culture. American Express believes it's always easier to stay ahead when there's someone behind you. Easier to focus on what matters, to follow what interests you, to explore, to discover. And with American Express, you don't have to go it alone because they have your back. Don't live life without it.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. All summer long, we're sharing stories about reinventing yourself as part of a series that we call You 2.0.
Rebels are not troublemakers. They're people who break rules that should be broken.
Subscribe and embrace your inner rebel. No leather jacket required.
Joining us now is Leah Littman, an assistant professor at the University of California, Irvine School of Law. Professor Littman, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is someone who's been through the judicial confirmation process. 16 years ago, Michael McConnell was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit. He served from 2002 to 2009. Today, he is a chaired professor at Stanford Law School, where he teaches constitutional law, and he joins us by phone from Southern Utah. Judge McConnell, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Leah Littman, let me start with you. Can you give us like a federal judiciary 101, how it might be similar to or different from the state courts that we might be used to? Can you give us just the basics of the system?
Sure. So there are three levels in the federal courts. There's the Supreme Court, which sits at the kind of top. Then there are the courts of appeals, which are the appellate courts at the federal level. And then beneath them are the district courts, and those are the trial courts at the federal level. The district court judges, there are about 673 district court positions that are authorized by statute. There are about 179 circuit court positions at the federal level also authorized by statute. And those courts hear a lot of cases. So, for example, in the district courts, there might be 290,000 civil filings in a given year and just short of 100,000 criminal cases that are live in the federal courts. In the courts of appeals, you have anywhere between 30 to 40,000 cases in the courts of appeals at any given time, and then there can be many filings in those cases. So they hear a lot of cases at those different levels beneath the Supreme Court.
I guess this speaks to why the lower court appointments are so very important. They have a lot of, they hear more cases, Leah, and they kind of have a lot of say over decisions, even kind of influencing what happens at the higher levels.
Exactly. The Supreme Court can't possibly hear all of the cases that are coming out of the courts of appeals. The Supreme Court will hear something like 70 to 100 cases out of the 7,000 requests it hears. That's compared with the 30 to 40,000 cases that are actually in the courts of appeals. And the courts of appeals, because they hear more cases, can also move the law in important ways, thus shifting the baseline expectations for what the law is and what lawyers think it should be.
So there is a real kind of an upstream effect from lower courts.
Yes.
Judge McConnell, let me ask you about your experience being on an appeals court for nearly a decade. Talk to us about how you got nominated to and appointed to that court. Were you doing your the previous job and then got a phone call one day? How did that work?
That's almost what happened. I had been a tenured professor at University of Chicago and had moved out to the University of Utah for family reasons. And doing my teaching, I practiced law on the side. I had done, I think, 11 arguments in the United States Supreme Court, had served in the federal government earlier in my career. And when George W. Bush was elected president, I found myself on his shortlist for possible nominations.
Why did he put you on the shortlist? What was it about you that appealed to him?
Well, you'd have to ask him. I like to think it's my sterling character that led to the nomination.
Naturally. Now, what was the process of getting onto the courts like in terms of confirmation, you know, having your background looked into, answering questions? How does that work?
Well, I tell you, it's a very unpleasant process. It is deeply politicized and not very fair to the nominees. And this is true whether we're talking about Republican or Democratic nominees. It's a very brutal process. When I was first nominated, the party of the president had a one vote majority in the Senate. One of those senators flipped parties so that sort of unexpectedly, the opposite party had control over the process. And it took 19 months between when I was nominated and when I finally got a hearing and was confirmed.
19 months.
I'm not the worst. I mean, there were many others that got delayed even longer than that.
And this was just political gamesmanship?
Certainly, that's the way I looked at it.
Now, you were on an appeals court for nearly a decade. Did you have the experience of having any of your decisions appealed up to the Supreme Court and heard by the justices, or did the cases mostly kind of end at your level?
Well, the vast majority ended at our level. I did have a few go up, and I'm proud to say that my position was actually vindicated by the Supreme Court every time.
How much, if at all, do judges at your level or the lower court level even think about, you know, other appointments, higher appointments? I mean, did you ever contemplate, Michael, being an Associate Justice of the United States?
I confess I thought about it.
And what was that like? Was that an aspiration or just kind of a, oh, this could be fun, this could be nice?
Well, I was, if you go by press reports, on the short list for the seats that went to Roberts and Alito, and it was a very intriguing possibility.
We are speaking to former Judge Michael McConnell of the 10th Circuit and Leah Littman, an assistant professor at UC Irvine School of Law. We'd love to hear from you as well, your questions or thoughts about the federal judiciary, its composition today, and how its composition is changing under the Trump administration. Email us 1a@wamu.org. Lee, I wonder if you could answer this question from John, who tweeted, Supreme Court appointments are rare, but is there a sudden exodus of lower court judges, or is Trump appointing a normal amount compared to other presidents? What is the average number appointed by each president? Leah?
I don't know that there's an average number appointed by each president. What President Trump had, however, is an astonishing number of vacancies to fill. When he began his presidency, there were 103 vacancies, whereas when President Obama started his vacancy, there were merely 54. That is, of course, partially because after the Senate changed majorities and became a Republican majority Senate, they slowly, and then eventually not at all, were confirming the president's nominees. And so that created a large number of vacancies that were open at the beginning of President Trump's presidency, allowing him to fill more positions than he otherwise might have.
So this is an extension of the whole Merrick Garland controversy about his Supreme Court nominee.
Merrick Garland, but in the lower courts. Times 10.
Judge McConnell, let me ask you, you were on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. Give us a sense of what the 10th Circuit is like. I understand that Utah is part of the 10th Circuit. How is it different than, say, the 9th or the 2nd or the 3rd? Do the different circuits have different reputations, different characters?
Yes, they do. So the 10th Circuit is in the West. It's headquartered in Denver. It's very much a Western Mountain and Great Plains Circuit, and our court was, you know, fairly balanced in terms of appointments from Democratic and Republican presidents, and at least we prided ourselves on dialing down the level of partisanship, so that we were a very collegial court and not a court that tended to go to either extreme.
Do the courts tend to have an ideological bent overall? I mean, have they always been somewhat partisan, Michael, or does it vary?
Well, I think when a court gets an overwhelming number of judges from one party, that it certainly begins to show. The social science research on this is pretty clear that when people, when there is a lack of balance, that the people, and this isn't just judges, this is people in general, tend to move to a more extreme position than they would ordinarily have been in if they were on their own. So that being among like-minded people tends to drive folks to more of an extreme. And some of the circuits are more one party than others. This has to do with the large states that have that are solidly blue or solidly red. So the Ninth Circuit, for example, has California, and there have been two Democratic senators forever, and that means that the Ninth Circuit is very heavily populated with judges of that party.
Right.
The Fifth Circuit, which is centered in Texas, is exactly the opposite.
We'll continue our conversation with Leah Littman and Michael McConnell, and we'll bring in another voice, someone who's been closely following the judiciary and Congress since the beginning of the Trump administration. That's just ahead after this.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Did you know you can ask Siri to play NPR podcasts for you? It's easy. Just ask. Like, play the Fresh Air podcast. Use your phone or HomePod to connect with your favorite shows anytime.
You know, when I got in, we had over 100 federal judges that weren't appointed. Now, I don't know why Obama left that. It was like a big, beautiful present to all of us. Why the hell did he leave that?
President Trump speaking to supporters at a rally in Ohio in this March. He went on to thank Obama for the vacancies, but he may not have been the right person to thank. Joining us now here in studio to make sense of the politics of all this is Charlie Savage, a Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Charlie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
So that comment from President Trump, he was kind of trolling President Obama in a way, saying, where did all these vacancies come from? He knows where they came from. They were clearly part of the political process. We mentioned that with Merrick Garland. Were there other factors, or do we view this as purely political, that all these vacancies existed?
So to think clearly about this, I think the first thing we need to do is throw away the district court judges and all those numbers. There's just too many of them, and the trial court's ideology doesn't matter. That's not where this culture war political battle is playing out. If we look at the appeals courts and, of course, the Supreme Court, which is where ideology matters much more and where these fights are happening, it is absolutely true, of course, that Trump inherited a seat in the Supreme Court because Mitch McConnell would not bring Merrick Garland's nomination up for a vote or even give him a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. If you look at the appeals court seats, it's actually not that true that there was an unusual amount of appeals court seats left open. Donald Trump had about 11% left open when he took office. Barack Obama had 9%. George W. Bush had 16%. What had happened, though, was that there had been almost no confirmations at all in Obama's last 2 years of office after a sudden flurry of confirmations in 2013 and 2014. And so the numbers evened out because there had been this deluge and then drying up of the spigot. What had happened was the Senate Democrats had abolished the filibuster rule, which permitted Republicans in the minority in that era to block Obama's nominees to the appeals courts, even though they didn't have a majority of the Senate. And after they changed that rule and allowed an up and down vote on any nominations, Obama got a ton of confirmations in late 2013 and early 2014. But then Democrats lost the Senate. and partly as retribution in this sort of endless tit-for-tat escalation of judicial politics, Republicans shut down the confirmation process at that point.
Let me get to a few of your comments before we continue with our panel. Jerry emailed, please talk about how often cloture and filibuster were factors from 1789 to the present, and how many of those occurred during the Obama administration. It seems that half of those occurred during the Obama administration to block his nominees. Charlie, I don't know if you are that much of an American history scholar that you can go back to the ratification of the Constitution, but I do get where Jerry's coming from. There seems to be at least this feeling that the use of the rules of the Senate was kind of targeting Barack Obama personally in a way that many Democrats still are smarting from, that this was not just political, but it was personal.
So although there's a few examples of filibustering in the 20th century on judges, not really for ideological reasons. And we did, as I mentioned earlier, have judges who were blocked without a vote using other mechanisms, like simply not bringing them up for a hearing in the 90s. That was pretty common. But it was really Democrats in the George W. Bush years that innovated the approach of filibustering judges systematically that they thought were judicial nominations that they thought were too conservative. And then Republicans did the same to Obama, perhaps at a higher pace, when they came in and the parties were flipped. It's a little hard. The numbers are a little bit fuzzy because in some cases for Senate Majority Leader at the time, Harry Reid, was filing cloture motions when it wasn't actually clear that there was a filibuster happening, just to sort of keep the process moving along.
And just to be clear, cloture is the process of limiting debate on an item. You can set debate for a certain number of hours if 3/5 of the Senate agrees to that.
That's right. And so one way to end a filibuster before it was abolished was to file cloture. And then if you could get 60% of the Senate to say, yes, let's move forward to a vote, the filibuster would have to end. But if you do that before there's actually a filibuster, it looks like there might have been one and there wasn't. I think that we can all agree, though, that many of Obama's nominees, both through the executive branch and to the appeals courts, were being slowed or blocked by Republicans leading up to this explosion in late 2013 when they changed the rules.
We're speaking to Charlie Savage of the New York Times, former Judge Michael McConnell, formerly of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, currently at Stanford Law, and Leah Littman at UC Irvine School of Law. Cal emailed, for Mitch McConnell to do a complete about-face and now fast-track nearly every nominee that has been put to the Senate is disgusting and reprehensible. They are not acting in the best interest of the people. They are acting only in a partisan capacity, and it has further cemented my distrust in the conservative party. It is not draining the swamp. It is making it worse. I presume, Cal, you meant the Republican Party rather than the Conservative Party. But at a press conference in the White House Rose Garden last year, McConnell did describe the kinds of judges the president has been choosing, which, as we mentioned, have been getting fast-tracked lately.
Conservative, and when we say conservative about a judge, what we're talking about here are the kind of people the president's appointing to the courts believe that the role of a judge is to try to rule based upon what the law says, not what they hoped the outcome would be. Justice Scalia used to say, if a judge is not occasionally unhappy with a conclusion he reached, he's not a very good judge. Or as Justice Gorsuch put it down in my state a couple of weeks ago, judges don't wear red, they don't wear blue, they wear black. And those are the kind of people the president is sending up to the Senate to be confirmed. Many of them, as he pointed out, younger, who will be on the bench for a long time and have a great deal to do with what kind of country we're going to have far into the future.
Part of what Mitch McConnell said at a White House Rose Garden press conference last October. Leah Littman, let me bring you back in and get your take on the way that this whole process has gone, particularly the kinds of judges that Mitch McConnell helped stonewall during the Obama years and is helping to fast track during the Trump years.
Sure. So some notable nominees that Mitch McConnell stonewalled would include the president's nominee to the D.C. Circuit, Caitlin Halligan, or a now justice on the California Supreme Court, Goodwin Liu, who was one of the president's nominees to the Ninth Circuit. And those and many other nominees were stonewalled for a combination of ideological reasons and just structural reasons. As you kind of noted, at the end of the president's term, the Senate just stopped moving forward with any of his nominees. Now, of course, the situation is reversed, and Mitch McConnell is more ideologically inclined toward this president's nominees. And while he says these nominees are conservative in the sense that they enforce what the law says, it's also true that what they think the law says happens to align with a good number of the Republican Party's ideological causes. So, for example, they believe that the Second Amendment restricts the number and kind of gun regulations that states can impose. They don't believe that the Constitution limits states' ability to restrict abortion. They do believe that the Constitution limits states' ability to use race-conscious measures and race-conscious remedies, such as affirmative action. And so it's true that these judges have a coherent judicial methodology and interpretive methodology, but it also so happens that they are selecting from a pool of individuals that have a group of views or a set of views that Mitch McConnell knows and is favorably inclined toward.
Michael McConnell, could you talk a little bit more about your confirmation process? You were nominated by a Republican president, but confirmed by a democratically led Senate. How did that go in terms of your previous rulings, your views on hot button issues like Roe v. Wade and so forth? What was that like?
Well, certainly the process then was highly charged, highly politicized. Everything I had ever written as an academic on those subjects was scrutinized. But I have to say it's been getting worse and worse. That it was bad enough then, that was 2002. It grew much worse just a year or two later when the Democrats started filibustering nominees and blocking. Leah mentioned several who very distinguished individuals who were blocked, who were appointed by Obama and blocked, while there were very distinguished individuals appointed by Bush who were also blocked, people like Miguel Estrada or Carolyn Kuhl. And now things have gotten to the point where there are virtually no votes from the opposite party for nominees of the president. It's gone from, I was ultimately confirmed by unanimous consent, even though I was a pretty controversial nominee at the time.
I'm sorry, unanimous consent meaning basically they said, are there any objections? No? Okay, he's confirmed, as opposed to taking a numerical vote.
Exactly. There was that is not actually a vote. It means no objection. No one is being confirmed by unanimous consent anymore. The degree of partisan blockage is now very much approaching 100%. And let me issue a warning here that if the president becomes of a different party of the Senate, if, for example, the Democratic Party wins a majority in the Senate this fall, it seems if things are going the way they are now, the entire process will shut down, which means no judges will be confirmed. And that probably would lead the president to begin making recess appointments, which are short-term appointments that don't require a Senate approval. And we could easily see ourselves, instead of having an independent judiciary with people who, because of their life terms, not dependent upon parties, having short-termers who are very much dependent, we could be seeing the destruction of our independent judiciary. What has been going on, and both parties have done it, that each turn of the wheel has become more extreme, more partisan, less fair, less focused upon the qualities of the individual nominee. And we're heading for a very ugly place.
Well, and Leah Littman, I'm kind of wondering along that line, what does this combination of challenges, the vacancies, the partisan rancor, what does this do to the functionality of the judiciary? I mean, are federal courts working the way that they're supposed to?
So we talked at the early part of the program the volume of cases that the courts hear. And given that volume, the 30 to 40,000 cases in the courts of appeals and the hundreds of thousands in the district courts, it's true, as Michael was alluding to, if you do kind of close up the spigot and don't confirm any judges, that's going to create a real problem for timely and thoughtful resolution of the cases that are in the federal courts. You play even a little bit with the volume of cases that the court hears, and that will greatly extend the time that it takes for the courts to resolve them. So if you now reduce the number of judges or don't fill up vacancies that arise and you keep the number of cases constant, that's also going to delay the resolution of cases. It's going to put additional pressure on judges to try to resolve them more quickly and maybe cut a few corners. And yes, that could really affect the business of the federal courts, given the volume of cases that they hear and the number of judges that are required to hear those cases.
Leah, since you mentioned the backlog in the courts, the most recent, just by way of clarification, the most recent judicial backlog we've heard about is in immigration courts processing the matters of families that have been separated at the border. Is this related to that, or is that like another kind of court system that's outside of what we're talking about today?
That's another kind of court system. Okay. In the immigration courts, those are immigration judges in the Board of Immigration Appeals that are housed in executive agencies, not the federal courts. But it might be related in the following way. If you start getting emergency motions for stays of deportation for families that could potentially be separated indefinitely, and those emergency motions are filed in the federal courts that don't have enough judges to actually resolve them in timely fashion, then that could actually affect that area and that issue.
Charlie?
I just wanted to return to what Michael McConnell was saying earlier, which I thought was very interesting, because as a sort of a student of the politics of this, agree that the escalating tit for tat we're experiencing and you can trace it all the way back to Bork or even all the way back to Brown v. Board of Education if you want to, is reaching a crisis point. And I think we're already, in fact, at the place he's describing to some extent. The total shutdown of judicial confirmations, most famously with Merrick Garland not getting a hearing, but in the appeals courts too, the last 2 years of the Obama administration when Republicans had a majority in the Senate, followed by the deluge of confirmations now by simple majority vote since there's no more filibuster. This is the first time we've had a Republican president with a narrow Senate Republican majority, and suddenly there's a huge assembly line. So I think it's right that if Democrats take the Senate in a few months, they will shut down the confirmation process again. They will do to Republicans what Republicans did to Democrats. But I also I don't think it necessarily is the case that then we'll see a bunch of recess appointments, because I think that the Senate will simply never go out of session enough to give President Trump the ability to make recess appointments. Now we know from a Supreme Court case a couple years ago that they have to be out at least 10 days. So let us hold pro forma sessions. And we're at a point now where we're only going to get judges confirmed when the same party controls the White House and the Senate. And then we're going to get none confirmed whenever there's split control of the government. It's going to be a very polarized red and blue judiciary.
Before we have to move on, Charlie, tell us what a blue slip is. That's another kind of cross-party check that seems to have gone away lately.
That's right. So the blue slip rule is the practice of giving home state senators some degree of control over who gets nominated to seats in their state. And under President Obama, both when senators were, the Senate was controlled by Democrats and Republicans, you had to have two blue slips from the home state senators to win, to go forward with a nomination. And one of the ways in which the constraints have eroded is that under President Trump, Republicans have thrown that rule out and allowed nominations to proceed even when Democrats have objected to seats in their state.
Mike asked about conservative judges. Mike tweeted, "Please explain how originalist, i.e. what the founders intended and what they meant, compares to textualist, i.e. just the words in the Constitution. Scalia liked to claim both, but there are strong possibilities for there to be mutual exclusivity." Charlie, I'd like you to take this on, particularly as it relates to the fact that we are so much more polarized and political ideology seems to be factoring more into the kinds of judges that are picked. Do we run into certain nitpicks in terms of someone's ideology that can work for or against a nominee?
Well, those are two very different questions. And I'd also love to hear Professor McConnell talk about the perhaps slightly esoteric distinction between an originalist, does that's the original intent, or do we really mean the original public meaning, and how much the textual limitations matter versus what we think this word may have meant in a dictionary in 1789 or something like that. This is sort of an argument within the conservative legal movement about which of a very subtle shades of distinction they consider themselves to be. And I think the writer is correct that Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, for example, have slightly different approaches or had slightly different approaches to that. I would make just a pivot off of that. I think one point that's a good takeaway for the listeners that arises from one of the things we've been discussing is to notice how this escalation of partisan tit-for-tat politics and polarization, which has driven and been driven by the erosion of constraints like the filibuster rule, the ability of 41 senators to block a nominee, like the erosion or the relaxation of the blue slip rule, the ability of minority senators from a particular state to block a nomination if they didn't sign off on it, to push nominations more towards the ideological extremes. These constraints had functioned as an incentive for compromise, for a president of one party to sit down with, or really his staff, his White House counsel and so forth, to sit down with Democrats of the other party, senators of the other party, and come up with something they could both live with, even if it wasn't their favorite rock star pick. And now, without those constraints, when we're in a situation where we'll only get judges confirmed when the president has a Senate controlled by his same party and you only need 51 votes to do it, there's no incentive for those middle-of-the-road judges anymore. Each team is going to be wanting to get the rock stars on their ideological edges, and that's part of what this sort of accelerating spiral we're in.
Leah Littman, a number of people have been asking or raising a similar point to what Mark tweeted. Mark wrote, "We need to start the process to amend the courts." I think he means amend the Constitution. "We need to start the process to amend the Constitution, and let us vote for all federal judges and the Supreme Court. Let us vote on all judges. These men are one-sided pro-government judges. They couldn't win a vote." Leah, what about that? Letting us, the citizens, vote on the federal judiciary?
I'm not exactly sure what the mechanism for that would be. You know, I think that the system we have right now is a system that's envisioning we're selecting representatives who are going to vote for the judges that we would ourselves select. And so you're voting for senators in part based on the kind of judges he or she would confirm or nominate. And same thing when we go to vote for the presidency. You know, the election return suggested that one of the most significant factors for people voting for President Trump were the judges and justices that he promised to appoint. So, you know, I am curious about what a direct ballot initiative on each federal judge might look like. If that is a way to make judges more accountable, that's one way to do it, but it seems a bit unwieldy, and the system we have right now is at least nominally designed to do that.
I also kind of wonder how many people would actually bother to research all those judges. And I mean, you know, look at county judges, county circuit court judges, county family court judges who end up on your local ballot. When was the last time you actually researched that person and voted for them? Exactly. However, I do also take your point, Leah, about judges being an important reason for why people make decisions on the federal level. Mark tweeted, "Obama stepped up and tried to stop the SCOTUS tit for tat by nominating an excellent dead centrist in Merrick Garland." We're real low on time, Charlie Savage, but I wonder what you think we should be keeping an eye on going forward, particularly if there are any candidates or any nominees that we should be keeping an eye on, any issues in the federal judiciary we should be watching out for. How should we be keeping an eye on this going forward before we have to go?
I think the takeaway is that President Trump is in the White House today because of a deal he made with the conservative legal movement. He essentially said he would let them pick the judges, or he would pick only judges that they approved of. This is where the famous list of contenders that Don McGahn created and has revised for Supreme Court picks came from. Exit polls showed that court-motivated voters who otherwise would have been skeptical of such an unusual Republican, their turnout did put him into the White House. And he is amply rewarding them. If this big fight over Brett Kavanaugh does consume the fall, that may help him save the Republican Senate in the midterm. And if he holds on to a Republican Senate in the midterm, he will have a tremendous tremendous stamp on the judiciary. Already, he has had 23 appeals courts confirmed. He's got 11 more in the pipeline. If he gets those 34 in the first 2 years, he'll be amazing, unprecedented and historical. By contrast, Obama had 48 in 8 years.
Charlie Savage, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Charlie, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Leah Littman, an assistant professor at UC Irvine School of Law. Thanks, Leah.
Thanks for having me.
And former 10th Circuit Appeals Judge Michael McConnell, currently a chaired professor at Stanford Law School. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.